Good afternoon. I would like to call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order at 1:04 p.m. Today is Wednesday, March 4th, 2020. Members present are Representative Chris Tuck, Representative Sarah Hannon, Representative Dave Tallarico, Representative George Rauscher, Representative Sarah Rasmussen, Vice Chair Representative Greyer Hopkins, Co-Chair Representative Garen Tarr, and myself, Representative Lincoln. Before we start, I'd like to ask everyone to please silence your cell phones. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast, and our LAO moderator, Amanda Kraft. Today, the committee will hear a presentation from Lee Hart of the Alaska Outdoor Alliance, followed by an introduction of House Bill 151, Electric Reliability Organizations. We have an hour allotted to each of these items, and I'd like to ask presenters to please be cognizant of that. Ms. Hart, if you'd please come forward. Introduce yourself to the committee and begin your presentation.
Thank you, co-chairs, Representatives Lincoln and Tarr, for inviting us back again to give you updates and bring you new perspectives for Alaska's outdoor recreation economy. My name is Lee Hart, and I am the founder of the Alaska Outdoor Alliance. That has evolved. Our name is rather new, but we've evolved over time, and now we're setting on Alaska Outdoor Alliance and sticking with it. Our delegation, as I mentioned, will bring you updated information and new perspectives around the original premise of strengthening our economy and stimulating rural economic development and improving daily life through outdoor recreation, and believing that that should be a priority. After my brief opening comments about the state of the industry, you'll have a chance to hear from members of our delegation about why outdoor recreation matters and what you can do to support it. The numbers, as this slide suggests, speak for themselves. Through our efforts, the first ever statewide study of the outdoor recreation economy and manufacturing scene were conducted by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development. In March of last year, CED released the report that showed outdoor recreation economy contributes $3.2 billion in spending in Alaska. It also found that 58% of our residents say that opportunities for outdoor activities are the reason they live here. That's 58%. Then in September of this past year, the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis for the first time released state-level economic data showing that outdoor recreation accounts for 4.2% of GDP, making us the seventh largest outdoor recreation economy in the United States. Alaska also tops the list of just four states whose outdoor recreation economies grew faster than the state's overall economy. Between 2012 and 2017, outdoor recreation grew at a red-hot 19%, while Alaska's GDP shrunk 9%. We are a big tent, representing summer and winter, motorized and non-motorized interests, hunters, anglers, and wildlife watchers, makers and sellers, stewards and allies in healthcare and education. We are united to work to change the conversation and have a seat at the table when we talk about natural resource development and when we talk about investing in sectors that we can lead the nation. We need better apples-to-apples data about our sectors, and we need I believe that we need an inventory of assets of statewide significance and the ability to identify where the gaps in those assets exist, so we have a decision-making framework where we can figure out how best to invest our resources and our treasury to benefit this sector and its ability to influence our economy. It's a no-brainer. It has a proven capacity to deliver jobs, attract visitors, and bring cash into our businesses and communities, as well as improving the health and education outcomes for our people. Since 2016, when this effort got underway, we've sparked interest and engagement from others. We have stimulated dialogue and attracted support from the players you see on this slide in the tourism industry, local, state, federal land managers, industry partners, universities, businesses, enthusiast groups, conservation-minded organizations, and many others. Ours is an industry rooted in passion for our sports, our favorite places, and the gateway communities that are the base camps for those adventures. We are bikers, hikers, skiers, snow machine rippers, guides, outfitters, educators, and again, healthcare workers, builders, filmmakers, career public land professionals, planners, and many others who connect with this industry consciously, not because we couldn't figure out something else to do, but because it does put roofs over our heads. It sends our kids to school. It keeps our dollars and our manpower, making our communities better and stronger, and affords us the work-life balance that we enjoy. I've brought with me to this hearing some other individuals who will help tell this story of how broad an impact our industry has, and again, why you should pay attention, and from their various perspectives. So I'd like to first introduce Don Stryker, who is the acting regional director for the National Park Service.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for what you do. I wanted to start by saying that. It's so terribly important, and I suspect you get a lot of pitches and you don't get enough thanks. So I appreciate your service very much. As Lee said, I'm currently the acting regional director, the Alaska director for the National Park Service in Alaska. The Park Service is about 3 million visitors, about a $2 billion industry right now. I included some slides in your packet, so I won't bore you with sort of the details. My day job is as the superintendent of Denali National Park, where I've been for 7 years, working hard to really try to integrate. I'm so thankful that you recognize that, Representative Tallarico. I work really hard to try to integrate community and park, because I recognize that in Alaska we haven't always been the best neighbors, and it's terribly important that we be relevant to our neighbors. And by the way, with national parks as your profession, it's not hard to be relevant, right? We're sort of all about kids and outdoors and jobs, important stuff. I wanted to thank you for your work on the House Joint Resolution 25, too. And because I'm Park Service, I'm going to use that as an opportunity to tell you a story. Last year I was here talking a little bit about the potential benefits of South Denali. But really, it was the House Joint Resolution 25 that got me thinking about the keys to success in the other five places that I've been in the United States as a park superintendent. And what really struck me is after we had sort of an ill-advised press release misinterpreted that stated that the road in Denali might possibly be closed for a portion of the upcoming tourism season, and people recognized, oh my gosh, that's the magnet for tourism for all of Alaska, and it has outsized impacts as people are making their Alaska cruises in advance, and it would have a ripple effect sort of analogous to 2008 if the road were to be closed. We can't have that. And you all galvanized to make sure that everybody was rowing in the same direction and that all of our collective brain power and resources were oriented to sort of this notion of we need to make sure that we get that road open because it's that vital to our economy and to our own, in fact, recreational opportunities here. It reminded me of a story of when I first got to West Virginia, the New River Gorge National River, sort of the best of the West in the East, right? Big water, great climbing opportunities, awesome trails. But when I first showed up there, I went to Walmart on the Saturday before I had even started. And somebody came up to me and started berating me and accusing me of trading the state's wild turkeys, which were just in recovery, for rattlesnakes. And I had come recently from Mount Rushmore and Rocky Mountain National Park, Lewis and Clark in Astoria, Oregon. I sort of enjoyed a relationship with my community that was all positive, right? It was all roses. And I had no idea where this angry person was coming from, but I quickly learned that that was the nature of the relationship there in southern West Virginia. People were very, very angry about the Park Service, and it manifested itself in some sort of silly ways. The Park Service was perceived as being anti-hunting, anti-access, and the way it manifests itself was just this notion that somehow we were interfering with the state's ability to restore wild turkey habitat. Where the rattlesnakes come from, I have no idea. But very early on, that motivated me to try to establish a relationship with the state that could overcome that. And so I went to Charleston, and we had a joint session, and I talked to some of the delegation there about sort of the advantages of perhaps working together on some initiatives if we could find them. I had Congressman Nick Rahal sort of drag me in by the ear to meet the governor, and he sat me down and he said, okay, I've got my evil Fed. I've got him in line. Can we make sure that we get these state people in line too? So instead of focusing on sort of silly differences, we focus on what our constituents want from us collectively. And so from that conversation, we basically started with a project to take the 876-foot-high New River Gorge Bridge, which was state-owned, but the access points were owned by the National Park Service, and we created a bridge walk with a very new for the Park Service collaborative concessions opportunity. And so now you can go there and you get a harness and you clip in and you can walk out on this inspection catwalk under the bridge, and lo and behold, it started putting southern West Virginia on the map. You fast forward that, the governor saw fit to put a Park Service person on his team to try to promote the area to the Boy Scouts of America, who were looking for a new permanent jamboree site and a new high adventure base. We pitched a spot of land immediately adjacent to the park, so that we could leverage the 70,000 acres in the New River Gorge National River as opportunity for the boys to be whitewater rafting and galvanizing. Once again, a lot of haters, even inside the organization, that were sort of against certain principles of the Boy Scouts at that time. But we stayed focused on what's our joint mission, right? And it's about the kids and the ability of the kids to have this experience. And the upshot of that was we won. That was $500 million in private investment over the next 10 years. And now every 4 years you have the Jamboree families bringing their boys and girls these days to the site of the Jamboree, and really an amazing opportunity to put West Virginia on the map. And bootstrap themselves up. I only bring up that story because for 7 years I have struggled. It has not been as bad in the Denali borough, but I have really struggled watching the relationship between the National Park Service and the federal government and the state of Alaska, candidly. We seem to like to focus on our differences, and I get that during an election year. Sort of, I'm okay with that during an election year. But I've never been anywhere where the Park Service is the bullseye of federal overreach, right? I understand EPA. I understand IRS. But really, the Park Service? Come on, man, we're all right. And I get the ANILCA provision. I guess all I'm suggesting is use us, use that Arrowhead, one of the five top recognized brands in the world, to figure out how we can leverage our collective responsibilities or our collective opportunities here in this outdoor rec space. Other states are ahead of us. And this is an important and vibrant, sustainable, and more importantly, growing economy. And I think we've got a bunch of certified smart people that if we can get, and if we can collectively, and this is a criticism of the Park Service as much as anybody else, look beyond our boundaries and plan collaboratively for the things that raise the ocean, right, and float everybody's boats, and not be so parochial, not focus on sort of where we have differences of opinion. That West Virginia story, did we still have disagreements over trapping versus people who wanted to run their dogs? Sure. But that wasn't what was occupying all of our space. That wasn't what was occupying the direction that we were giving our federal delegation, right? If we can identify those areas where we overlap and stay focused on those things, and man, we've got great opportunity for it. So that's my simple pitch. I wanted to be here too in case you wanted to ask any questions about road lottery or the road will be open on time. You heard it from me. The road will be open on time. And I just thank you, and I look forward to any questions that you might have.
I don't see any. Thank you. If you can just please be sure to state your name and affiliation for the record before you speak.
Yes, thank you all. My name's Dan Kirkwood. I'm the general manager of Pack Creek Bear Tours here in Juneau, Alaska. I'm also the co-chair of the Visitor Products Working Group at the Juneau Economic Development Council. And our focus has been on advocating for recreation priority in national forest management. Of course, here in southeast Alaska, the Tongass National Forest is a key area of focus for us. But also, of course, the state lands that we have and the private lands that we have in southeast Alaska are incredibly important to the recreation economy. And when I think about Don's explanation of the importance of the road through Denali, it reminds me that at the core of the recreation economy is infrastructure and natural resources. And those are our public lands. Those are our trails. Those are the access points up behind my house here in downtown Juneau where you can get onto a trail that would take you into a place where you could go hike as far as you ever needed to. Or it could take you into a community where you could meet people living a different way of life than maybe folks do in the lower 48. And that those opportunities that we have in Alaska are an incredible economic opportunity that need all of our attention. And so to think about our trails the same way we think about our roads and our bridges, to think about the wild places the same way we think about our trails. There's a whole diversity of opportunities that we have here, and as a consequence of that, you have an incredibly diverse array of businesses, from the cruise lines all the way down to independently owned companies, lodges, hunting and fishing outfits all throughout our state that really bring home time and again the Alaskan hospitality that we're famous for. Again, the Denali Parks Road, access to one of the most famous landscapes in the world. Here in southeast Alaska, more than half the people who come to visit our state come here. This is where people come to see Alaska. We have one of the world's most recognized brands. This is things that corporations pay millions to maintain. Corporations are very attentive to the value of their brand and what people think about their brand. And have you ever gone anywhere in the world and told someone you were from Alaska and they said, "Where's that?" Have you ever said, "I'm from Alaska," and they said, "No, I never heard of it"? Or have they ever said they had a negative opinion about Alaska? We have seen threats to our brand before. We have seen controversies that threaten our brand. And to the tourism industry, to the visitor industry, that's not good. We need to be wary of our brand because we have things that no one else in the world has here to offer for sale. That's our competitive advantage as a state, amongst others, amongst a whole diversity of opportunities that you guys spend a lot of time thinking about. But I would just urge you to add this to the things when you think about the riches we have here in our natural resources and infrastructure.
Representative Tarr has a question.
Mr. Kirkwood, could you just tell us a little bit about the Juneau Economic Development Council Visitor Product Cluster Working Group.
That was incredible, Representative. Thank you. I typically pass out if I run the whole name myself. The Visitor Products Cluster Working Group, which refers to the economic cluster of the visitor industry, not the fact that it would be a mess to bring all those people together, is a business-led group that focuses on ways the visitor industry can collaborate for all of our benefits. How do we all work together to make sure that all of the boats are rising together? So the Juneau Economic Development Council brought this group together. They continue to support our group. I'm very honored now to be a chair of that group. And we've worked on things very specifically, permits for the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. We've worked on improving access and focus for the National Forest Service broadly throughout Southeast. Again, it's important for it to be business-led. You know, we're looking for what can we bring to the table so that we can all work together. I'd say the other really valuable part of that group has been the participation of the Forest Service. When we get the land managers to come into our group, we get to learn about all the language that they use, the way that they see the world. When folks from the City Assembly come, that's really important because we get to learn about the way the City Assembly sees the world, the way that you guys see the world. And then we can in turn share the way that as business managers we see the world, and we can all start speaking the same language.
My name is Michelle Stevens, and I am president of Petersville Committee Nonprofit at Petersville, Alaska, near South Denali. I am also ambassador to the Alaska Outdoor Alliance. I would like to talk about the SnowTrack program, but first I will give you a little history. The Snowmobile Trails Advisory Council, known as SnowTrack, was established under Title 41 in 1997 through the offices of the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation, with the mission to fairly represent all Alaskans by advising the Division of Parks on snowmobile issues, including funding, safety, registration, education, access, trail grooming, marking, development, and maintenance. The SnowTrack program was intended to support the local communities in the winter economy. Alaska statutes authorize the Division of Motor Vehicles to collect snowmobile and off-highway vehicle registration fees. The statute does not state what the fees will go towards. However, since inception, the promise and understanding was that DMV would transfer all fees generated to the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation. The intent was once the funds were received, the DMV Division of Parks would establish a state snowmobile advisory board for the SnowTrack, and that the funds received from DMV would be spent on trail grooming as well as snowmobile education and safety projects. I would like to clarify that the SnowTrack program is funded through a self-imposed user tax, a snowmobile registration fee. The program is self-sustaining due to the reoccurring registration fees collected by DMV and the point-of-sale registration fees collected by snow machine dealers at the time of purchase and re-registering your snow machine. It's a revenue-neutral program that users asked for and fund out of their own registration dollars. 12% of the funds cover the cost of state parks employees and administrative cost. At the time the SnowTrack was put into place, snow machiners were proliferating for recreation, transportation, and subsistence use. There were very few marked trails and maintained trails. The consequences were high accident rates, lost snow machiners, which is a cost to the state of Alaska, winter conflicts among trail users, and conflicts with private property owners. The SnowTrack program has been a success. It took many years of brushing and cutting trails, surveying and mapping out trails. The communities have received SnowTrack funding, have succeeded in achieving all the goals the SnowTrack program intended it to be. People are getting to their remote cabins safe. They are buying and hauling fuel and supplies. More land is being purchased and cabins are being built because of the ease and safety of the trail system being marked and groomed. Remote businesses are flourishing. They are building, hauling fuel and supplies, all due to the SnowTrack program. During the last 7 years, the Snow Track program has seen a decline in funding for several reasons, mainly lack of enforcement of registration, so people are not re-registering their snow machines, partly because they don't understand the benefits and partly because they don't trust the governor will keep the program alive. Since the Walker administration, snow machine clubs, businesses, and nonprofits have had to fight for the fees to be reinstated in the Snow Track program and not to be included into the general fund. Due to the registration fees being only $5 a year and lack of enforcement on the trails, the Snow Track program is quickly becoming a program of the past. Our funding has dropped from $250,000 per year to $150,000 this year. Over the past years, snow machine clubs, businesses, and nonprofits have strived for an increase in registration fee. This legislation session, we hope to succeed in House Bill 23 to continue with the Snow Track program. Representative Mark Newman has introduced House Bill 23, which increases our registration fees from $5 to $10 per year. Snowmobilers spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in our winter economy, otherwise would be slow. Winter tourism is on the rise because of this groomed trails, which provide responsible riding, safety, and winter highways. On the average, a single snow machiner spends $50,000 in a season. And you take like a snow machine costs $12,000, a truck costs $30,000, a trailer that you pull the sled costs $15,000, and so forth. It just riffles down into the economy. A study done by Earth Economics in 2015 found that for every $1 spent on public open space in the Mat-Su borough, there was a $5.31 return on that investment. The groomed trails have helped considerably in keeping the cost of the state of Alaska search and rescue to a minimal. With signs, maps, and groomed trails, riders are less likely to get lost. This means the troopers are called out less, and so the cost to the state of Alaska is less. I've been involved in SAR since 1989, since the groomed trails have been introduced. Petersville Search and Rescue has had less rescues to respond to. The groomed trails are critical to first responders. They allow expedient access to the backcountry, thus helping the victims sooner and less likely to suffer loss of life or limb, and allows the ease of transportation with victims with broken limbs. The Snow Track program benefits all Alaskans and anyone who wants to enjoy all that Alaska has to offer in the winter. Snow Track saves lives, promotes safety, stimulates the economy, and creates jobs. If the Snow Track program does not continue, it will devastate businesses, clubs, and outdoor activities in all of South Central Alaska. Who will be affected? The entire Matanuska Susitna Valley, 16 clubs, 20 businesses, 39 lodges, 15 snow machine dealers, 10 dog machine events, including the Iditarod and Iditasport, 24 snow machine events, 3 fat tire bike events, and more than 66,000 snow machine registered owners. The Snow Track program is a one of kind in the state and should be an example of other user groups for their service needs.
Thank you, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. I really appreciate it. But when you were saying snowmobile, did you mean snow machine?
I guess that's where you're from. It depends on where you're from. Snowmobile, snow machines, tomato, tomato.
I forgot to mention that Rep. Sponholz joined us at 125 for a panel.
Thank you. So my question is about snow machines. I mean, snow.
Good one.
Through the chair. Last year, when we were looking at the budget, some of the Snow Track money license fees was being put into another. Not all the money that was being collected from DMV was being given back to Snow Track. And I think we fixed that last year's budget.
What happened last year was that the governor took the Snow Track program out of the budget, and it again is out of the budget. You did fix it last year, but this year it's been overlooked, and I have wrote letters to the governor and the executive branch to reinstate it, and I think that there's a lot of support for that.
Okay. Yeah.
It will go into the capital budget, so it'll be like the last thing.
Now, when you follow up, can you tell me where you heard that?
Heard what?
That'll go into the capital budget in this last thing. We passed the so when we looked at the Department of Natural Resources budget this year, it wasn't flagged for us to come up. So we didn't talk about it, even though we were the subcommittee that looked at the budget, that it should have been it should have been at the front burner of us to pay attention to, but I was a freshman last year. It was the first thing I ever knew about the snow track license fees, because I don't own a snowmobile or a snow go or a snow machine, so I haven't paid that $5 license fee. So you made me aware of it. We followed it last year, but what I'm hearing you saying is it's not in the operating budget this year, and you've heard that it's going to be restored in the capital budget.
That's what I've heard from, do I have to name names? But I don't want to get anybody in trouble, you know, but that is what I've heard.
Okay.
And I'm hoping that that's what will happen, but there's no guarantee. May I address the chair, please? I know that you and I have talked in the past of certain issues in your community, and I'm working on that, and I have a meeting with you tomorrow at 9:30, and I'd like to discuss that further, where we can maybe get a statewide snow machine association and have clubs and everybody join it, and then we could reach out to the communities like yours, where you have special needs, where you don't use groom trails, but you need signage and things like that. So
I appreciate that. We have a floor session, I believe, that was just scheduled for 9 a.m., so we might have to reschedule that, but I'd love to have that conversation with you. Okay. So, and Rep. Rasmussen, you got a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious, you noted that a lot of people, the registration has been on decline for the last 7 years, and I'm curious if you think that increasing the fees from $5 to $10 will continue to disincentivize people to register, because, I mean, it sounds like a great program. I hope that we're able to continue to have more people register.
Yeah, there's been a lot of cogitation about this. What is the solution to the decline? So part of the reason it declined was there was 5 years that we didn't have a whole lot of snow. I see that as a problem. The biggest problem is the lack of enforcement that we have for the registered snow machines. The troopers they're just stretched so thin, they're not going out there and hunting down people that don't have registered snow machines. That's something that I've been working on. Lee and I have talked, we've thrown so many ideas back and forth, and we've thought about a one-time registration fee of $150. That would be the life of a snow machine. You know, 15 years is about as long as a snow machine will last, unless you really took care of it and want a vintage. But I think that it would help raising the fees. I mean, $5 is nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody eats a $10 Subway sandwich every day, and this is $5 a year. So we're hoping that the fee will help.
I've heard some of the comments we've heard include, include that this lack of confidence that the funds will actually go to where they're supposed to go. So I think turning that dotted line from DMV to DNR into a solid line and increasing that assurance, and I know we have constitutional restrictions, but any way we can do to shore that up, I think that's part of, it's a confidence issue among some of our riders.
Just a quick follow-up. I would caution against a large one-time initial, my initial thought was, oh, that could be good, thinking about the state receiving a big pot of money in the beginning and expecting that to draw out over 15 years or the life of a snow machine. I would caution that that's probably overly optimistic. So probably having an annual fee for funding purposes is better. But yeah, I appreciate all that you presented about today. It was really interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I believe up next is Mr. Chris Beck.
I'll save it.
Sorry about that.
No, that's right.
Well, like others, thank you very much for the chance to share some ideas and ask some questions about how you see your role in some of the things we're trying to advance. So I'm Chris Beck. I am a board member of a statewide nonprofit called Alaska Trails. A sidebar of my previous 15 years is a company called Agnew Beck Consulting, but I'm doing this on behalf of this statewide nonprofit, Alaska Trails. So I believe in your packet you might have a trusty handout. I might make a couple references to that. But what I want to do briefly is cover three subjects, a little bit about the opportunity that outdoor recreation and trails provide, a little bit about the benefits, and then some actions to try to take advantage of those opportunities and benefits. The starting summary statement, I don't think I have to say this too loud or too frequently to convince folks, but we have an amazing outdoor recreation set of resources in Alaska, and we do not really begin to take full advantage of those. And we're 365 million acres. And we've never as a state in any kind of systematic way thought about how we could really take advantage of those for economic reasons, for quality of life reasons, and also to maintain their quality, because if we don't do the latter, we can't maintain the former of those. So that's the starting. That's the opportunity. The many benefits, Lee has touched on some of them, the one I'll emphasize, which I do, like the Chatty Cathy doll, for those of you who are my age, remember a doll that would say the same thing over and over again, is that if we could get just half of the current out-of-state visitors to Alaska to spend one more day, it would be $137 million in additional spending, just at current rates. In Alaska, the average stay is 9 days. A comparable destinations in another part of the world, New Zealand, another long haul, you have to fly to get there, destination, the average stay is 19 days. So just imagine if we could go from 9 to 10 to 11. It's literally, it's in the quarter to a half a billion dollars of additional spending. And I think what distinguishes perhaps New Zealand from Alaska is they have phenomenal outdoor recreation opportunities, trails, huts, bike trails, marketing, management, etc. When I was there with my wife, we walked an 80-kilometer trail, and every night our suitcase bag was in our hotel. I went down there because my wife didn't want to hike that trail in Alaska and carry her backpack. Mm-hmm. People go from all over the world for those kinds of opportunities. So that's the opportunity, and those are some examples of the benefits. The how we get there, obviously, is the challenging piece of all this. So on the handout, the page that looks like this, and I can describe it. You don't have to religiously follow along, but this is one example of we're trying to more systematically look at where those infrastructure investments would be valuable, would bring all those benefits. Someone came up with the notion of the Seward to Fairbanks Adventure Corridor, and it's clearly a primary road corridor in the state, and it's one where there are already a lot of visitors, but they're expecting to be many more. As the cruise industry grows, there's a new port facility being planned in Seward that's going to add to the volume of travelers there, and many opportunities. This illustrates a bit about some of those examples. I'll touch on them very quickly. Up in Tanana State Forest, just to the west of Fairbanks, we're working with the State Division of Forestry to identify a place where timber harvests and trails development can take place. There are a lot of precedents in the lower 48 for that, very successful ones, for example, in Bend, Oregon. Those two things are side by side. You ride bikes there and you'd be past an area that was harvested a week ago, and now it's reopened, and they work well together. We'd like to, we have a pilot project. We got some funding to work on that in Tanana State Forest at Rosie Creek. Another example further down the highway in Representative Tallarico's district, there are a handful of trail projects in the front country of Denali. That's particularly important because there are ultimately limits on how many visitors we can send down the park road, even with the confidence that that road will be open again this summer. But nonetheless, the front country, a lot of opportunities, so we're working on a series of projects with the borough, with the Park Service in that area. Jumping down into the Matsu Borough, there's the possibility of really improving the Hatcher Pass Independence Mine area into more of a destination, an overnight destination. There's opportunities, and this gets into the world you folks oversee, which is the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation has, for years, been dramatically underfunded. This summer, Independence Mine is not going to be open for any of its facilities. There'll be a parking lot. Right now, there's a huge underground system of old mines that could be a tour that you could set up and run. You could have tours inside the buildings, but there's no budget for that year. State Parks barely able to keep up with emptying trash and cleaning restrooms. Chugach State Park, on the threshold of Anchorage, has zero budget for its trails. If somebody needs to buy a $15 hard hat, they have to go do a fundraiser and sell some cakes and get the money and buy the hard hat. So what I think we're wanting to leave you with is we are sitting on huge opportunities. There is many, many benefits to be had through both development and wise stewardship, but we do need leadership and realistically need funding. some of the funding opportunities that are highlighted here at the bottom of this page, there are federal funds that are coming to the state, but that the state has elected to not take receipt authority for. Land and Water Conservation Fund would offer right now $2 million to Alaska. It's sitting on the doorstep, but there was a decision to not take receipt authority for those funds, and consequently, those are not available. They do require 50% match. It's not just a direct handout. But those are dollars that the state, local governments, the state itself could be using for all these projects and would bring a lot of benefits. A thought we want to also throw out is the possibility of a general obligation bond. There have been those in the past. Those could provide the investments that dramatically provide a dramatic return on investment. So the administration is working on this. We're working with the Department of Commerce, Community Economic Development. Keith Comstock is the governor's point person there, with Ricky Geese, who's the director of Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation. He and I will talk about the Fairbanks to Seward Adventure Corridor indefinitely, given us the opportunity. And I'll just wrap up by saying we have these huge opportunities. We really look forward to working with you and finding a way to take advantage of them.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, through the chair. I am curious if you think that the park and trail users would be open to increasing the fees for parking lots, or, I mean, are there other ways that we can identify user fees? I personally am happy to pay to park when I go to hike Flat Top or, sure, you know, one of the parks in the Anchorage vicinity.
Lisa thought, and I'd probably add something.
Yeah, so I think I used to manage four state park units.
I just want to remind people, it's helpful to restate your name when you begin speaking in response to the question.
Through the chair, Lee Hart with Alaska Outdoor Alliance. As a former manager of four state park units in Valdez, I can tell you that one of the things that State Parks does work on is creating the automated fee stations, for example. A lot of the problem is kind of like the enforcement thing, right? So even though we took out over as operators of those parks, they still didn't have a way for us to really make sure that people were paying. And the out-of-towners paid a lot, but we're pretty sure that the locals are. So I think making sure that when state parks request those types of funds for that type of thing, I think that that's the low-hanging fruit, is let's get the money from the people who are already coming, and then I think then talk about fee increases. I know when we managed the park, we took over the park, Blueberry Campground up on Thompson Pass, and we raised the fees from $15 to $20 for overnight camping, and it was as if we, you know, took somebody's firstborn child away from them. So it's the fee increases are, you know, always angst-filled, but I think the biggest thing is collecting the fees at the parks that we have.
Representative Sponholz.
If I might add just a response to that, if it isn't premature, I don't.
Well, I want to dovetail on something Ms. Hart was just saying. I think it's not just collecting fees from people that are coming already, but making it easier for them to pay.
Exactly.
As a frequent parks and trail user, I can't tell you the number of times I've gotten up to a trailhead and realized that I didn't have the $5 cash.
Right.
And so moving to, you know, digital collection makes it easier for people that are regularly using, and making it easier for people to buy year-round passes, for example, potentially at those, you know, those fee stations will dramatically increase just paying by people who want to pay.
Yeah, through the chair, that's an important distinction I forgot to mention, is that the ease of payment, because the other thing was we raised it to $20 because we couldn't make change for everybody. So,
right.
So
yeah.
When you have those electronic things, and I think we've put in some solar powered ones, then that definitely is revenues go quite.
Yeah, so Rep. Rapson, I'll also note that we've got less than 15 minutes budgeted for this presentation and five more presenters to go. So just want to note that for people. Rep. Rasmussen?
No, I'm good. I'll catch you offline. Thank
okay.
you.
If I might, with 20 seconds, the other half, I believe, of the response, this is Chris Beck again, is making very explicit the link between the money that goes in and the benefits that come out. And I think that is a theme in Alaska that people are suspicious about how the money would get used, and I would be honest, and say we're also not accustomed to paying for the things we enjoy. And so there's an educational process, but it really helps when people say, okay, this money went in, and as a result, this trail I love is better. So it's the combination of technical solutions and kind of an educational process.
Thank you, Mr. Beck. Ms. Rhodes?
Through the chair, we do have two fewer speakers than are listed, so that would help.
Okay. Who do you not expect?
So we're on Diana Rhodes. Natalie Dawson isn't able to join us, nor is Sierra Gader.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Diana Rhodes with the Anchorage Park Foundation. We are the nonprofit partner to the Municipality of Anchorage Parks and Recreation. So we do fundraising to help supplement any federal, state, and local funding that we can get to support our parks and trails in Anchorage. As Chris mentioned, that there are some projects that people are willing to pay for, and I want to tell a short story just about Anchorage, Municipality of Anchorage, choosing to put on the ballot every year a parks and recreation bond package. The Municipality of Anchorage has that power, one of the communities in the state that has that power to put it to the voters. And about 15 years ago, when the Anchorage Park Foundation started as a nonprofit partner, the park bonds weren't passing. So they would be put forward every year and they wouldn't pass. And these bonds were about $4 million. There's never been more than a $4 million bond. It's roughly, this year's is $3.9 million, kind of roughly $3.9 million a year for a park bond. When the foundation first started, they weren't passing. But after 3 or 4 years of having an advocacy partner to educate folks about, you know, how it's working and what's getting built and what your money is being used for, then in the last 10 of 13 park bonds, they have passed. So that dollar, this year it will be $1.65 that Anchorage voters will see an increase in their property taxes for a $100,000 assessed value, $1.65 to get $4 million worth of park and trail improvements. And so that's one benefit, just to let you know that people are willing to pay for it in, you know, one of the largest communities in Alaska. They're willing to pay for it. So that's hopeful. The legislature, I worked in the legislature a few years, and in the years when there wasn't a lot of money, the legislature chose to have some general obligation bonds. It went to voters. 2012 was the last year where some bonds were authorized. 65% of voters approved that in 2012. I can't remember how much money it was for. But those kinds of investments in infrastructure, when we're looking to develop our outdoor recreation economy, there are a few gaps. Like Chris was saying, there's some gaps that can't be paid for with local bonds. It needs a statewide approach or a federal approach. One project that we're looking for here is this. We've realized that our existing transportation infrastructure in trails, it's the Tony Knowles Coastal Trail, the Laney Fleischer Chester Creek Trail, the Campbell Creek Trail, and the Ship Creek Trail, when you put them all together, it looks like a moose. And so we want to be promoting this. When you look at it on a map, it looks like a moose. It's crazy, but it does. And we just noticed that recently. We're like, ta-da! We have a marketing opportunity for ourselves, but we need $13 million to build a bridge over one of the busiest intersections. Otherwise, we can't have like a mayor's marathon or a big ski race or any of these races that other communities are using to, you know, destination cities need destination trails. People are doing it all across the country. And when you think about parks and trails as your ability to attract and attain a quality workforce and attract investment to your community, trails have been proven to be the way to do that. Another way that we're looking at transportation infrastructure is at the federal level. We worked with the assembly to pass a resolution for active transportation and for the federal government to increase funding for these recreational trails program and the alternative transportation program. These are the key funding sources that Alaskans use to pay for infrastructure across the state for trails. The reauthorization of the federal transportation bill is happening right now. Don Young has been our champion in Congress for many years. It was his bill, the Safety Lou transportation bill, that was named after his wife, was the very first time that they did a pilot program for transportation alternatives, meaning, you know, bike and pedestrian amenities, and they studied it. And the information that came back from that was so astounding, really, that, you know, improving health care, getting people to not drive as much, saving, you know, air quality. The benefits were so remarkable that they've kept that program going. And so we just look to leaders like yourselves to, when you're talking to the federal officials, to ask them for increased funding through that program, because that's really valuable for communities all across Alaska. So I'll wrap up. It's possible to build this, develop this infrastructure for outdoor recreation, and we just have to keep it in our minds that it's important. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
I have a super fast question.
Yeah, Representative Rasmussen.
Sorry, yeah, through the chair. What was the intersection for the $13 million?
It is Lake Otis and Tudor area. The Campbell Creek Trail is an 8-mile trail. It's split in half. And it's you can't even do a push button, a crosswalk right there, because the Lake Otis and Tudor intersection is so close. So there really is no other way to get people safely across other than building a bridge.
I'm very familiar with that. Thank you, that area.
Yes.
Zip line. That's true.
Good afternoon.
Thank you so much for having us. I'm Jen Leahy. I'm based out of Seward, and I work on behalf of hunters and anglers across our state for the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership. Because my role is a new one, I'd like to take just a quick moment to touch on my organization and why our work matters for Alaskans. Our mission is simple. We work to guarantee all Americans quality places to hunt and fish. And we do that primarily by focusing on shaping federal policy that benefits not just hunters and anglers, but our entire outdoor recreation community. We focus on issues like safeguarding access to public land, ensuring healthy wildlife habitat and clean water, and also ensuring adequate funding for conservation programs. Our work is nonpartisan and highly collaborative. We're part of a partnership of 60 different organizations that represent the voice of sportsmen and women on the Hill. Although TRCP has been involved with Alaska issues since its inception, my role here is brand new, and we're excited to be growing our capacity in the state to help support more federal land management efforts here in Alaska. So to the fun stuff, I'm excited to talk with you all about wildlife and how important that is to all of us, not just culturally and recreationally, but also to our economy. ADF&G commissioned a study several years ago that helped us determine the economic importance of wildlife to Alaska. And just a couple of highlights I would like to share with you. In 2011, residents and visitors spent $3.4 billion on activities related to hunting and wildlife viewing. That in turn generated $4.1 billion in economic activity throughout the state. That's 8% of our total output. Wildlife-dependent recreation also generated 28,000 jobs, $1.4 billion in labor income, and more than $340 million in government revenue. None of that even begins to touch on the value of our sport fish, personal use, and subsistence fishing industries. The charter industry alone here in Southeast Alaska and in South Central generated more than $165 million annually in recent years. So all of this economic activity is dependent on a few things: public access to lands and healthy wildlife habitat and healthy fisheries. And that's why adequate funding for conservation is so important. Hunters and anglers drive spending in local communities and also fund conservation through our excise taxes and our license purchases. This community truly pays its own way. We're not talking about a group of people who show up looking for big handouts. This community invests in our industry, and that's one of the messages that I'm hoping to share the most today. So one of the most important things that we can do to help maintain a strong outdoor economic or outdoor recreation sector is to take advantage of federal funds that support wildlife and fish restoration. Alaska receives more federal money through the Pittman-Robertson Act and Dingell-Johnson Fish Restoration Act than any other state in the country except for Texas. It's approximately $50 million a year. And these funds are administered by ADF&G to pay for things like hunter education programs, hunter and public information services, refuges, special management areas, wildlife health and disease surveillance. And in order for ADF&G to receive these funds, the state's required to contribute a 25% match, which is typically covered through the purchase of our hunting and fishing licenses. Last year alone, I think we generated over $20 million through the sale of fishing licenses, over $11 million for the sale of hunting licenses. We have plenty of money coming in, and that helps generate all these matching funds.
We have another presenter after you, and I'm going to ask you to please wrap up if you can.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So it's important that our state budget process ensures that we're meeting all of the requirements for these programs so that we're not leaving federal dollars on the table. And I know that many of you probably participated in helping protect the state's allocation for those funds last year after those funds were initially vetoed. Thank you. And maintaining these conservation programs are essential, not just for our outdoor recreation traditions, but for our economic, our outdoor industry as a whole. Thanks.
I'll note also that we discussed a bill in committee recently that touched on this, so we were very recently sort of re-educated on the importance of those programs, and thank you for bringing them to our attention again. And we plan to have a future discussion in committee about the topic generally, which will touch on that also. So thanks again for being here today. Any questions from the committee? Okay, our last presenter with this group is Ms. Teresa Whipple. Will you please join us at the table?
Thank you. My name is Teresa Whipple, and I am representing the economic significance of commercial bear viewing in South Central Alaska because I'm a bear guide. I'm a bear viewing guide. I spend my entire year with bears. 8 months out of the year, I take visitors to see them in the wild, and the 4 months that you can't view them, I educate people about them through my own bear company. And so there is a very good reason why when people think of Alaska, this is the picture that comes to every person's mind. We have incredibly good bear habitat in this state, and especially in Katmai and Lake Clark on the shorelines of Bristol Bay, Western Cook Inlet, even the Tongass Islands here. We have very, very good habitat, and so it's not a surprise that Alaska hosts the largest and the densest concentration of brown bear found anywhere in the entire world. So as competing uses in these natural environments, in these good habitat places, as this grows, it is critical to consider the economic and societal benefits of commercial bear viewing as an outdoor recreation activity. In 2017, just in the Lake Clark, Katmai, and McNeil River areas, bear viewing companies reported over $34 million in sales. That's astounding. And that's also shouldn't come as a surprise because over 70% of visitors to this state come with the intention or the goal to view or photograph a wild bear. That's millions of people. And I'm just happy to be here today with Lee advocating for my industry. And I'll nip it because I know we're on time.
Any other questions? Any questions? Just curious, how close do you bring your to the
closer than my mother is comfortable with?
Okay. and just out of curiosity, what do you have equipped for bear protection if, in case one charges or?
So a multitude of deterrents is what I always carry because every situation calls for a potentially different outcome. My best deterrent is actually my voice and my body language, which is what I use 90% of the time. I do not carry a firearm in any of the places that I guide. I generally defer to the company with which I'm working for has outlined bear protocols that I follow depending on the area because bears act differently in different areas, and so they are used to or not used to different kinds of deterrents as well. But my go-tos, if that's helpful, are either bear spray or a flare, bear flare.
So nobody in your group typically has a firearm when you're guiding?
Not typically, unless I'm operating in polar bear country. So in the Arctic, it is part of the protocol for Arctic viewing guides to carry firearms when you take visitors to see polar bears.
You're much braver than I am. So, yeah. any questions? Thank you very much for your presentation. Did you have any wrap-up, Lee?
I did have wrap-up. On the page that says, back in the earlier part of the deck, that says the Unsung Economic Powerhouse, you'll find what our asks are this time, and that's to open the doors for the outdoor recreation economy. We want to thank you for your support, again, of House Joint Resolution 25 concerning the Denali Park Road. We want you to work to balance the budget and come up with the funding formulas so that you don't have to spend the majority of your session talking about those issues, and you can move on to talking about other priorities that help make Alaska the great state that it is. So we would like to get to a place where we can catch up on the $60 million deferred state parks budget, and we can begin to budget for capital improvements to make that system even stronger. We want you, as Jen said, don't leave money on the table. Make sure we're getting receipt authority and matching those funds from the federal government that bring critical dollars to habitat restoration and access, as well as recreation development. We want you to embrace user-funded programs like the SnowTrack program. You can see, like, from the one page, this page in particular, there's a diversity of data that we have in our sector. We'd love to have another state report that gives us apples-to-apples comparisons from the same source, from a state source that you can all trust as reliable data. And then we'd like to make sure that just in general you're expanding your minds and your definitions of what it means when you talk about resource development, and that outdoor recreation is part of the resource development formula in this state when you talk about, the constitutional requirement to develop our resources to the maximum use consistent with the public interest, with 81% of Alaskans spending time outdoors every year. I would say that that's a pretty compelling public interest. And then also on the infrastructure side is remembering that outdoor recreation, our infrastructure is trails and public use cabins and boat launches and things like that. And so just like you have airports for airplanes and ports for ships, we have, these are our infrastructure needs for this sector and for getting our people outside and welcoming our visitors. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Any further questions? Thanks again for making the trip down. Appreciate your time today. We'll take a brief at ease, setting up for the next presentation. Okay, we're back on record. Our next item of business today is House Bill 151 from House Special Committee on Energy. Representative Hopkins, you and your staff are with us at the table. Please introduce yourselves and introduce us to House Bill 151.
Thank you, Chair Lincoln. For the record, my name is Representative Grier Hopkins, House District 4, North Fairbanks. Thank you today for the opportunity to present House Bill 151 to the Resource Committee. Not often do we consider legislation that has a legitimate shot of untangling an issue that has bedeviled Alaska's leaders for decades. Today, we might just get to do that with 151. Alaska's rail belt, stretching from Homer to Fairbanks, is home to the majority of Alaska's populations, of course, and it is served by six separate electric utilities: Homer Electric, City of Seward, Municipal Light and Power, Chugach Electric, Matanuska Electric Association, and the Golden Valley Electric Association. The consumers of the rail belt have benefited from strategic state and utility investments in new electrical generation, transmission infrastructure, and renewable energy projects. However, realizing the full benefit of these investments has been stymied by disagreements, mistrust, and a whole lot of history between the players, as well as multiple sales between the utilities, mergers and acquisitions of utilities along the rail belt, and simple parochialism, a phenomenon I call the rail belt two-step, one step forward, two steps back. In 2014, the Alaska legislature asked the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to examine the rail belt and make suggestions on how to efficiently and effectively provide electrical service to the folks who call the rail belt home. In a letter to the legislature the following year, so 2015, the RCA proposed the formation of an Electric Reliability Organization, or ERO, as a way of fostering greater cooperation and resource sharing among the rail belt utilities. In the following years, there has been some progress, one step forward, and some good changes, and two steps back when the utilities and multiple stakeholders were not able to come to agreement, they were working on agreements only to see them fall apart at the last minute. But over the past 12 months, that progress has accelerated. The RCA crafted proposed legislative language last spring based on guidelines developed by the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, or NERC, tailored to Alaska's unique, that those recommendations were tailored to Alaska's unique situation, and the RCA released that language for public comment last spring. In December of 2019, maybe it was 2020, sorry, it might have been January, the six utilities signed a memorandum of understanding to establish the Rail Belt Reliability Council. That is an ERO, the balanced board of directors that the utilities work together with stakeholders and various other organizations. The House and Senate charged various special committees, the House Committee on Special Committee on Energy and the Senate Special Committee on Rail Belt Electrical Issues. We crafted legislation and moved these bills forward towards enactment, and here we are today. Today's bill, I'm pleased to report that the House Special Committee on Energy has worked closely and diligently with our counterparts in the Senate. We've heard the bill, we've all heard that there are many ways to skin a cat, and I'm convinced, however, that a bill this complex, far-reaching, and comprehensive has only been possible because of the close collaboration and cooperation between the legislature, utilities, independent power producers, consumer advocates, renewable energy proponents, and the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Following our presentation by me and my staff, you'll also be hearing from Regulatory Commissioner Anthony Scott, Julie Estee, the Public Affairs Manager for the Matanuska Electric Association, who will be representing the Organizational Development Team, the ODT, that is the utilities working together with the Rail Belt Reliability Council. There's a lot of acronyms in this presentation that'll come up, so I apologize. And they'll be able to answer any technical and timeline questions for the committee. The bill before you is the exact same legislation, down to the punctuation, as the bill being considered in the other body. We've worked very closely with the sponsor over there and have met routinely between myself, that sponsor, and our staff to incorporate or not incorporate the requests from all the different stakeholders and utilities involved, making this a very good piece of legislation that has gone through a number of phases and seen a lot of cooperation between usually entities that don't agree. This bill has been unanimously endorsed by the RCA, the Rail Belt Utilities, consumer advocates, renewable energy proponents, and independent power producers. I'd like to thank all of those parties involved for their work in crafting this legislation through numerous hearings, teleconference, and changes. Chair Lincoln, thank you again for hearing this today. And I'd like to have Joe Hardenbrook, aide to the Energy Committee, walk through the bill.
Mr. Hardenbrook.
Good afternoon, Chair Lincoln, members of the committee. For the record, Joe Hardenbrook, committee aide to the House Special Committee on Energy. I'll try not to duplicate the comments of Representative Hopkins in my presentation. And let's go ahead and get started. In 2014, the legislature provided a capital budget appropriation of $250,000 to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, asking them to examine if efficient and effective electric service to the rail belt could be accomplished through greater integration and cooperation amongst the utilities. In 2015, the RCA made some recommendations saying there's much room for joint work, but they advocated that before the state or the RCA mandated changes to let the utilities try a voluntary approach to solving. In 2019, the RCA reported back to the legislature, stating there have been good efforts and some progress, but no institutional reform to date. They proposed a public process to discuss statutory changes, putting forth model language that the RCA developed based on language from the North American Reliability Corporation. Utilities and shareholders weighed in, and the RCA incorporated their feedback into their final proposed legislative language. And those that language was incorporated into two bills that were introduced at the end of the 2019 session, Senate Bill 123 and House Bill 151. In 2020, the RCA followed up with the legislature, stating that despite the efforts, institutional change had not yet occurred. The overriding goal of the legislation continues to be capture the progress to date and maintain forward momentum to the benefit of ratepayers through improved reliability, improved security, and avoiding future costs for expanding the rail belt electrical system. Just to give you a quick rundown on the components of House Bill 151, it says a new article and sections to Alaska Statute 4205, the Alaska Public Utilities Regulatory Act. The bill adds a new article to 4205, so a few sections to the bill, but it adds 10 new sections of statute to that new article. House Bill 151 authorizes the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to require and manage electric reliability organizations, or EROs, for interconnected power networks. The legislation defines participation in an ERO, as well as the requirements, responsibilities, and oversight of an organization. The ERO will be responsible for establishing reliability standards and conducting integrated resource planning for the interconnected network. Large projects in an ERO network will require pre-approval by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And I'm moving fairly quickly through this presentation in the hopes that Commissioner Scott of the RCA can make his entire presentation, as well as hear from Ms. Estee from the Matanuska Electric Association. Participation in the ERO is also defined in the bill. Interconnected networks must have an electric reliability organization, with some exceptions. Public utilities in that network must participate in the ERO. All users, owners, and operators in the network must comply with the reliability standards set by the ERO. The rail belt is the primary need for this legislation, but the legislation has been designed to have general applicability in the future as Alaska's electrical networks continue to evolve. And there are several release valves incorporated into the legislation to accommodate future expansion or development in Alaska. For instance, if all load-serving entities petition the RCA, the RCA may grant a waiver for forming an ERO in the future. Also the inverse. If you have a network but not quite a system and you want an ERO, utilities can petition the RCA to form one. Page 2 of the bill sets up a process for forming the ERO. The RCA is instructed on page 2, section C, to notify the utilities in a system that the RCA requires an electric reliability organization for their network and opens up the doors for application. An organization can apply, and the RCA will ensure it meets certain requirements, which we'll cover in the next slide. The legislation has also incorporated a backstop in the case that no one applies to serve as an ERO. The notification starts a clock, 90 days if no one applies, 270 days if no applicant meets the requirements as determined by the RCA. And then at that point, the RCA would form an ERO. This reflects a statutory requirement for the RCA, 3 months to apply and 6 months to certify an application. The ERO framework, the required structure in House Bill 151, governed by an independent or balanced board or a combination thereof. This is the required structure for the electric reliability organization. They must have an open and inclusive process, balancing the interests of the different utilities and the stakeholders, and the ability to develop standards and integrated resource plans for the rail belt. Note that later in the bill, on page 5, an ERO is required to file its rules and changes with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. This bill is designed to be proscriptive, not prescriptive, because we're not sure exactly what the future holds for Alaska's electric utilities. The responsibilities of the ERO, the RCA delegates certain work to the Electric Reliability Organization, but maintains the oversight, authority, and the ability to assign tasks to the Reliability Organization. This is the bottom-up approach that capitalizes on the abilities and the expertise of the network players who know the system best. The Electric Reliability Organization would set and enforce reliability standards and develop an integrated resource plan for the rail belt. The reliability standards for the network are subject to RCA approval, and the ERO would enforce the standards with the Regulatory Commission serving as backup. The ERO or the RCA can penalize violations of these reliability standards, and there's also a provision in the bill for conflict resolution. The ERO would develop standards for cybersecurity, keeping the system safe, efficient, and reliable. The standards developed by the ERO shall be submitted to the RCA as a tariff filing. Section 4205-770 requires the RCA to write regulations requiring the ERO to have, in its tariff, standards for non-discriminatory open access transmission and interconnections, and for the transmission and for transmission system cost recovery. The RCA can accept the reliability standards proposed in the ERO, modify the standards, or reject them, but only for form and filing. Further, it sets up an appeals process. Penalties have to be reasonable in light of the violation, and the ERO will enforce standards. Again, the RCA can backstop these standards and create and enforce its own penalties. I would point out that there is a special carve-out for Doyon Utilities, which serves some of the military bases in interior Alaska, basically a carve-out that allows Doyon to adopt
actually, excuse me, it allows Doyon to follow Department of Defense standards for reliability in serving those military installations when they conflict with any sort of state regulations put forward by the RCA. The integrated resource plan is also required planning for the network, how to meet the needs of the rail belt at the greatest value consistent with the public interest. Again, this integrated resource plan is subject to RCA approval, and items that are approved in the plan are considered to be necessary moving forward unless the plan is modified. This gives the projects that are included in the integrated resource plan the benefit of moving forward without action by the RCA.
We have questions from Rep. Tuck and then Rauscher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when we talked about the EROs,
yes,
and the number of networks, potentially where we'll ask is right now, how many could that be?
The Representative Tuck through the chair. The RCA anticipates that currently the rail belts is the only interconnected network system that would benefit from an ERO. There are specific carve-outs for some interconnected utilities here in Southeast Alaska. The Southeast Alaska Power Authority is established by statute and is exempted from RCA oversight. So the SEPA network, which I believe connects Petersburg, Ketchikan, and Wrangell, would be exempted from the requirement to form an ERO.
Okay. And a follow-up? And then in the future, as more of get them established and more networks are built, is it possible to have an ERO within an ERO?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, according to the legislation, each interconnected network will only be served by one ERO.
Okay, and then one additional question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On well, the I know Doyon's exempted, but does Doyon, do they have their own power generation too, or are they also part of the grid, but because of their nature with their contract with the Department of Defense, as you mentioned?
Sure.
So are they part of, they don't do any more power generation. I know there's a power plant out there, right?
Yes.
Do they rely on that, or is that a backup?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, my understanding is that Doyon Utilities manages the coal-fired power plants at both Eielson Air Force Base as well as Fort Wainwright. They produce their own power. They are interconnected to the grid, but the carve-out here allows them to comply with the Department of Defense standards instead of RCA standards.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And I would note also for the record, the University of Alaska as well maintains independent power generation. They are interconnected to the grid as well. However, they would be required to comply with the reliability standards of the legislation.
Okay. Rick Rauscher.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, or co-chair. I think I'm going to wait till the next presentation. I think that'll help answer my question.
Okay. Thank you, Rep. Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Hardenbrook, help remind me, are all the utilities where this ERO would touch, from Homer to Fairbanks, members of this working group?
Representative Hannon, through the chair, yes. All six interconnected utilities are members of the organizational development team, and they've been a part of helping to weigh in and crafting of the legislation.
Okay. Follow-up? You used the word interconnected, and so that's where I'm like, are there some other independent utilities that are not interconnected but are in the same geography?
Representative Hannah, through the chair, good question. There are Doyon Utilities, for instance, is an interconnected utility there. They are not considered to be a, correct me if I'm misspeaking here, and I'm sure that Commissioner Scott can weigh in as well, but I do not believe that those are considered to be public utilities because they I'll let Commissioner Scott weigh in on that, but those utilities do provide power. They are interconnected, but they are not, I believe, currently subject to RCA regulation.
Okay. One more follow-up. You said that if the law passes, large new projects would need pre-approval. Don't they already need pre-approval from the RCA?
No, ma'am.
I can build a utility and then see if they will come.
Representative Hannon, through the chair, it's my understanding that currently if a utility has a large-scale project which is approved by its board, it can move forward.
Okay. Thank you.
An expansion to that, Representative Hannon, through the chair, one of the big reasons to move forward with this bill is we've had about $1.5 billion worth of new generation infrastructure built on the rail belt in the last 10 years, and there's a very interesting fact on how much it costs rail belt ratepayers now to pay for those capital improvements that Commissioner Scott will go into at the beginning of his phrase. But that is part of the big reason for this, is having the utilities plan together as opposed to all of them making their own generation.
Talbico, do you have some?
No.
No power in his district.
Please continue.
All right. Power to you, man.
Thank you, Representatives. Moving on to slide number 9, continuing on project pre-approval. On page 8, the new section, on page 8, the new section, statute 4205-785, this provision is not a pre-approval of project costs. The project has yet to be done, so the costs have yet to be prudently incurred. The RCA decides if a project is necessary to the network, if it complies with the standards, and is a cost-effective way to meet customer needs. And again, a project that is included in the latest integrated resource plan is considered to be necessary and approved. Clear and convincing evidence is required in order for the RCA to remove a project from the IRP. At this point, I would be happy to take any questions from the committee. Also, just wanted to make sure the committee was fully informed. The Energy Committee did forward the bill with a letter of intent. This letter navigates some of the challenging terrain related to the Bradley Lake project and the associated transmission infrastructure. This has been under litigation over several years. Basically, what the intent language does is it covers the continuing differences in interpretation of what contracts governing Bradley Lake actually mean. And the letter says that the legislature is not going to wade into the debate, that it will let the utilities work the issue out without us taking sides. And the legislature intends that this bill, House Bill 151, the standards, the integrated resource plan, project pre-approval, all shall apply to the Bradley Lake project and its transmission lines, but that the legislature will honor the exemption from RCA review until the debt for the project is paid off. And the intent language is included in your packet. Finally, I just wanted to show you a chart developed by our colleagues over in the Senate, just sort of showing how the relationships under this bill would work. As you see, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska continues in its primary role at the top. Then the ERO, which is being called the Rail Belt Reliability Council, is down underneath there, which is composed of the 6 utilities, as well as with ex officio board seats for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, the Attorney General's Office. AEA has a reserved seat on there, as well as seats for the for 2 consumer groups and independent power producers. And then down underneath there is the network, which the ERO would govern, which is the Rail Belt Electrical Network, including battery and compensation devices, non-utility power producers, the utilities, and the independent power producers. At this point, if there's no further questions from the committee, I'd love to
talk as a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your page 8. On the project pre-approval for large energy facilities, is part of the approval, and I don't see it in here, just was curious about decommissioning a project as well, or how the co-ops or the ERO will handle that?
Representative, that is a good question. I would suggest that we punt that to Commissioner Scott.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. So independent power producers, I've heard told and seen pictures of Matsu Solar Farm. Mm-hmm. If they now want to join this ERO, do they need approval from the ERO board, or does it have to be unanimous? Or
the Representative Hannon, through the chair, the legislation is designed to allow for additional power producers to enter into the system. The ERO would be charged with developing the regulations that govern how those power producers fit into the network, and they would be required to comply with the reliability standards, including the cybersecurity measures that are detailed in the legislation. So the ERO's board would be responsible for drafting the rules with RCA oversight that would allow those projects to gain access to the grid.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we have a couple people scheduled for an invited testimony, including Dr. Anthony Scott, a commissioner at the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, and Julie Estee, who was introduced earlier, with the Matanuska Electric Association, who also represents the organizational development team. There are others on the line as well from different utilities along the rail belt available for questions. And at this time, who did you want to have speak with the committee?
Chair Lincoln, at this point, we'd love to hear from Commissioner Scott of the RCA. Okay.
And does he have a presentation as well?
Okay. Yes, sir.
Get that loaded. Are you there, Commissioner?
I am. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We just got the presentation pulled up, so if you'd please introduce yourself and begin your presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Anthony Scott. I'm a commissioner with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Very pleased to speak with you today about a bill that we are all very excited about. It represents the culmination of many years of work, thousands and thousands of pages of public testimony, and a great deal of work behind the scenes by the utilities, various stakeholders, and the commission. So time is short. I want to briefly touch on three things, namely what the RCA does and why it matters, and the cause of certain inefficiencies within the overall electric rail belt system, and then the things that the bill does to remedy those defects, which is a loaded word, but we can do better. So on slide two, this is just to remind you, the RCA does economic regulation. We don't do environmental regulation or product quality regulation. Actually, we kind of do. We regulate the terms of service around that utilities interact with their customers are. So we regulate rates. We regulate the quality of service. It's a very kind of unusual arrangement. Not very many sectors of the economy have economic regulation, public utilities do. That's about it. The reason why we are engaged in economic regulation is because electric utilities, among other public utilities, are natural monopolies, which means that there is not a possibility of effective competition. And the reason why that matters is because generally in competitive markets, you are insured of outcomes that are economically efficient, that provide the lowest cost and the best quality that consumers demand. But because of the particular technologies involved, we can't get effective competition in the electric utility sector. And so what we have instead are monopoly franchises, and the utilities operate within their franchise, and they strive to provide safe, reliable, and affordable power. Our statutes are designed to ensure that the terms of service that they offer are indeed, realized outcomes that reasonably emulate what would result if markets were, in fact, fully and effectively competitive. So that's our job. The stakes are high. In 2018, consumers within the interconnected rail belt spent about $880 million on electric utility service. Roughly speaking, half of that was a little bit more, was the fixed cost of paying for the system, that is, paying for the wires, the generating stations, the transmission, distribution, batteries if they exist on the system. Once those capital expenditures are made, they get paid for over the next 30 years, and consumers are necessarily on the hook. The way that we regulate the interconnected public utilities on the grid, each one, again, has a separate certificate, and we regulate each separate set of terms of service for those entities. And that ends up creating the opportunity for less than fully efficient results, which the legislature recognized, I think, in 2014, when they asked us to take a look at whether there might be ways of innovating and ensure and capturing better efficiencies between the utilities and the work that they do. So, Joe, if we could jump to slide four, please. In 2015, the commission found, after thousands of pages of public testimony, lots of hearing work, that indeed there was room for improvement. At the time, we had inconsistent and adequate and unenforceable reliability standards because the parties didn't agree amongst themselves as to what the standards should be, that there was insufficient planning between utilities to capture savings in capital expenditures, that we did not have a good way of ensuring that enough and the right kind of transmission gets built, because any piece of transmission on the system provides benefits really for everybody in terms of increased reliability. But we don't have a good model for making sure that everybody contributes and pays for those improvements. We don't have a good business model. And then lastly, that the operation of the hardware that's there, that there were opportunities for increasing the efficiency with which it operates. This bill addresses the first three of these insufficiencies. So it provides structures in place to create consistent, adequate, and enforceable reliability standards, and that's especially important as we have new technologies evolving and new parties that want to interconnect with the system. It helps ensure that any new infrastructure that's built is done in the most efficient way possible. And it provides an avenue, a pathway, for solving the problem of a lack of a business model for making sure that people contribute towards and equitably pay for new transmission infrastructure. So, Joe, if we could please jump to slide six. One of the RCA's recommendations to the legislature in 2015 was that we allow a period of time for voluntary efforts to be made by the stakeholders and the utilities to solve these problems on their own. And indeed, in the intervening 5 years, there has been significant progress. The voluntary efforts have not resulted in institutional reform, however, and part of that is simply because we lack the statutory authority that's needed. But also, it is a function of the fact that cooperation is difficult and expensive, and there are lots of reasons to attend to the priorities of ensuring the operation of one's own system, rather than trying to work with others to see if there might be sort of new efficiencies that might be gained. And that's totally reasonable and understandable. But it means that opportunities for improvement can get left on the table. What HB 151 does in its companion bill in the Senate is it cements the progress that's been made to date and ensures, through enhancement of the Commission's current jurisdiction, that the progress that's been made results in new institutions which deliver efficiencies and savings to consumers. Given the amount of money which is spent every year on electric utility service, even very small increases in the efficiencies with which the system as a whole operates can provide very material savings to consumers each and every year. As Joe mentioned, the bill addresses consistent enforceable reliability standards. Those standards, at the end of the day, in addition to cybersecurity and physical security standards, those standards are really about ensuring that you have adequate generation and transmission capacities so that you can instantaneously match the supply of electricity with the demand that's there. And you want to do that in a way which is as cost effective as possible. And so that's why the bill requires that there be integrated resource planning to help ensure that efficiencies between and across utilities are captured. And then lastly, what it does, is that large projects that represent large amounts of capital have to come to the Commission for project pre-approval. If a large project has been contemplated within a integrated resource plan, then it's presumed to be needed and necessary for the system, and that indeed efficiencies have already been captured. But lastly, the bill provides a way for solving the transmission infrastructure business model problem so that we can get the utilities and the consumers to pay for new transmission as it's needed. I guess one of the things to stress, and Joe, if we could please jump to slide 9, that the way the bill works is by ensuring the existence of an electric reliability organization, which the Commission itself has jurisdiction over and regulates. That organization itself then is charged with, its mandate is to perform the coordination function between both the utilities and a broader range of stakeholders and users of the interconnected system. So that's what its job is. It performs this coordinating function, which to date, the Commission does not exactly have that clear jurisdiction to do. We regulate each of the utilities separately, severally. So we would not delegate our ultimate authorities over safe, reliable service to this organization, but we would instead effectively assign most of the work to the ERO. And the bill ensures that because we are a backstop in the event of inaction or disputes that haven't been adequately resolved or insufficient attention to the public interest, that because we are a backstop to any potential failings of the outcome of the ERO process, it creates powerful incentives for the ERO to get the work done at that level and get it right so that the Commission then can simply approve what comes to it. So on slide 10 is just points out that the bill meshes with our current statutory framework and processes so that in general what we would expect is that actions of the ERO come to the Commission for approval. They're subject to 45 days of public notice. That public notice would be sort of a last step following rules for public noticing of ERO meetings that have been held all along the way. And then, like most filings, we would expect ERO filings to be summarily approved. If there were problems, things that were unresolved, we could suspend those matters into dockets for commission investigation and subsequent adjudication. With that, I'll stop and ask if there are any questions.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Scott, do you know what the range of the cost per kilowatt hour is currently in the utilities who would be participating in this ERO?
Representative Hannon, through the chair, it depends. Roughly speaking, we could say the cost for residential consumers range between, I would say, 17 and 22 cents a kilowatt hour. The rates have gone up a lot in the last 10 years as this wave of new infrastructure has been built. And also as we've seen an enormous spike in the cost of natural gas in Cook Inlet. Most of our generation on the rail belt is fired with natural gas. And right now we are paying triple for natural gas, more than triple what consumers in the lower 48 are paying.
Follow up. Mr. Scott, would you anticipate that an ERO would have the ability to bring down consumer costs in any of those utilities, or does it not change that calculation at all?
Representative Hannon, through the chair, in the short term, right in the immediate, we would not see any step change downward in electric utility rates. Over the long term, I think we absolutely would and will. And that, again, is because the capital costs of the system are, roughly speaking, half of the overall cost. And the bill will help ensure that any new additions to the system are most efficient for the system as a whole rather than any individual utility.
And one more follow-up. This is a slightly different tangent. I happen to represent and live here in Juneau, where they have the highest concentration of electric vehicles and some of the cheapest electricity. Well, the cheapest electricity in Alaska, and one of the things that has come up in my attention as electric vehicles grow, the issue of charging locations and, the fantasy to be able to drive an electric vehicle from, say, Homer to Fairbanks requires you having the ability to charge, and my understanding has been that there has been some approach to the RCA, but a really complex dialogue of how those could be regulated, because every utility would have a different rate cost structure of what they need to charge, and it depends on the number of vehicles that use your utility. Have you contemplated how ERO could benefit that kind of infrastructure over the next 50 years as perhaps transportation goes more electric and would likely bridge different utilities?
Representative Hannon, through the chair, thank you for the question. We recently had a public meeting in which we had a long series of presentations around electric vehicles and the need for reform of the particular rate structures within the rail belt for fast charging stations. I think this is a problem which is actually readily solved. We are going to schedule a technical workshop with interested stakeholders to do scoping, to promulgate regulations ourselves around possible rate reform for fast vehicle charging stations within the rail belt at least, and maybe for broader application. So I think that's something that potentially an ERO could do, but we certainly don't need to wait for that. That's something that we can readily deal with right now ourselves, and I expect we will in the coming months.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I lost my question in the time that I was waiting for those other questions. That's okay. It will come back to me. I'll think of it. Pardon me.
Do we have any other Representative Tallarico?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate, Commissioner, your explanation of all this. Could you give me like an outline, brief walkthrough how we just get one of these organizations started? We don't have an ERO, so I assume if I read through the bill, there's an application process. Somebody submits an application, and I think a few years ago, some of us are familiar with what was referred to as a unified systems operator. I think that's what we were kind of looking into, either unified or independent systems operator from an RCA recommendation. But I see this. Can you just walk me through that process? The application goes to the regulatory commission, and then because it looks like there's some considerations for structuring a board and everything. What's the RCA's involvement there?
Thank you, Representative Tallarico, through the chair. The bill was, in terms of board governance, the bill was modeled on the federal legislation to avoid being too prescriptive and requiring fights in front of the legislature around the ideal governance. What the bill does instead is it permits a range of possible acceptable governance structures. If the bill is enacted, the commission will spring into action and have an incredibly busy year promulgating regulations for minimum requirements of what an ERO should look like. That will be an open rulemaking process with input from the public and interested stakeholders, so that the details around what an ERO needs to look like, its capacities, what constitutes independence, and so on, gets more fully fleshed out. Once those regulations have become law, have been promulgated, we expect to receive applications, actually at this point probably one, from the efforts that are happening in parallel by the utilities consistent with their MOU. And Julie Essie from the organizational development team can talk much more about what their process is to get ready as a potential applicant for the Rail Belt ERO. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, actually it does. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I wanted to ask about was if you could put this in the context of recent infrastructure that's been built in Anchorage, and how that might have looked different if this infrastructure had been in place prior to, for example, the new power generation plant in South Anchorage or some of those other things. Because what's happened on the consumer side of it, there have been a bunch of rate increases and things like that, and sometimes additional increases as the costs, were realized and adjusted. And so I think it would just be helpful to kind of think of it in a context of one of those examples?
Sure. Chairman Tarr. So I want to be a little bit careful because we still have proceedings in front of us, or potentially returning to us, I should say, around the prudence of Plant 2A, which was built by MLNP, and whose prudence in terms of whether indeed it was necessary was challenged by one of its customers, and that is something which ended up in court and then remanded back to the commission. The judge's decision, the commission initially found that Plant 2A was prudent, that MLNP was meeting the needs of its own individual service territory in a reasonable way. And the Superior Court felt that we hadn't taken a hard enough look and advised it to go look at that further. The kinds of things that she felt that needed to be looked at globally are exactly the sorts of consideration of alternatives that an integrated resource planning process would require. So the short answer is, if this legislation had been the law 10 years ago, we would have had an open and transparent planning process in which the actual needs for Plant 2A would have been considered not only with regard to MLMP's needs, but to the Rail Belt as a whole. And it's at least possible that significant numbers of millions or tens of millions of capital expenditure could have been avoided. I don't want to sort of speak too directly towards that, because that's an issue which may end up in front of us again.
Thank you. That's very helpful, and I think sort of like, yeah, helps us understand why this could be so effective. Thank you.
I think Mr. Hardenberg, do you have something to add?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, I just thought that a data point that might be interesting considering your question. 2018 is the most recent year for which the RCA has full data, and there was $880 million worth of electrical utility bills paid by consumers on the rail belt. And of that, approximately half went for paying for capital expenditures. So as Representative Hopkins mentioned, from 2010 to 2015, there was $1.5 billion worth of new transmission infrastructure built on the rail belt. All those costs went on to the credit cards, which now the consumers of the rail belt are going to be paying off.
Representative Sponholz.
Thank you. Through the chair, Commissioner Scott, I asked you a similar question to this in the Special Committee on Energy, and I'm going to ask it again. HB 151 or its Senate Companion 123, they don't have any reference to either economic dispatch or the increased use of renewable energy, each of which could potentially reduce cost to consumers and potentially decrease greenhouse gas production. Can you describe how an ERO could potentially address those issues?
Sure, I'd be happy to. An ERO will not have operational authorities under this legislation. It will not direct economic dispatch. So economic dispatch is really about using existing resources that have been paid for and put on the credit card in the most efficient way possible. We do believe, the Commission believes, that although this does not necessarily do everything, it helps considerably in a number of ways. One of the things that this is going to do is create a structure that ensures that all of the utilities and a broader range of stakeholders are regularly meeting, hashing through lots of issues, because they'll have to. And the cooperation that process will necessarily engender, I think, will help ensure that we do indeed get progress toward economic dispatch. There are additional reasons for thinking that economic dispatch, at least in the among the Anchorage-based utilities, may be forthcoming. We got very close a couple years ago to receiving a wholesale power contract which would have effectuated the economic dispatch between NEA, MLMP, and Chugach Electric. The acquisition at least temporarily scuttled that. But a decision on the acquisition will be forthcoming soon, this spring. And at that point, I think we'll certainly be open for business again in terms of progress on reconstituting or otherwise getting progress on a tight pool, at least among for the customers served by those utilities. Whether economic dispatch ultimately makes sense, between those utilities and Homer, or between those utilities and Golden Valley, is not something I'd like to prejudge at this point. It will depend in part on whether we have adequate transmission infrastructure to fully bring that forth. And that then becomes a cost-benefit test as to whether the benefits from higher economic dispatch across all parties of the rail belt are enough to pay for any additional transmission infrastructure that might be needed. As to your question about renewables, I think the bill clearly provides a pathway for enabling independent power producers to interconnect with the system and to get their to make sales of renewable energy across the system. That's because the ERO is directed under the bill to develop standards for cost recovery of new transmission, as well as critically interconnection standards and non-discrimination access standards. And both of those, creating a singular one-stop shop for where those standards reside, will enormously facilitate the ability of a wind developer in Delta, for example, to make sales of power to Homer Electric, for, which would otherwise, I mean, potentially they would have to deal with multiple jurisdictional tariffs and agreements. So I think it'll be very helpful for bringing new intermittent resources onto the system.
Thank you, Commissioner Scott. So we've run out of time today. This is a very important bill for both bodies and for not just residents of the rail belt, but also all Alaskans, because the implications of this bill could have consequences for PCE. High priority bill. We'll certainly be discussing it more in the future. Unfortunately, didn't get to our second invited testifier, Ms. Esty, but we will invite her back potentially Friday or next week. And unless there's any last minute questions from the committee members at this time, we will adjourn today's meeting at 3:03 p.m. Thank you, Commissioner.